This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Edvard Grieg's incidental score for Henrik Ibsen's play Peer Gynt contains some of his best-known and most popular music. Really, some of the most popular of all classical music. Morning Mood and In the Hall of the Mountain King have been used in hundreds of movies, television shows, and commercials. It's one of those amazing artistic miracles that a creative marriage that seemed so unlikely should have been such an overwhelming success. Grieg was already well-established as a composer when Ibsen asked him to score his play. The two had met in Rome in 1866 and had enjoyed each other's company, despite the differences in their personalities. Grieg was shy and sweet, Ibsen fiery and driven. The book of Peer Gynt was a modest success when it was published in 1867, and Ibsen began planning a stage production 6 years later. Grieg had admired Ibsen's text and understood it thoroughly, though he was completely unprepared for the task Ibsen set him, 26 musical numbers for the five-act play. Grieg complained that Peer Gynt was the most unmusical of subjects and that it had become a nightmare for him, but the production made Peer Gynt a hit. And the first time Grieg attended a performance at which his score was used, the play had to be stopped repeatedly so that he could acknowledge the audience's ovations with a bow of his own. Peer Gynt the character is the quintessential anti-hero. According to Ibsen translator Rolf Fjelde, Peer is a man with no ruling passion, no calling, no commitment, the eternal opportunist, the mirror of surfaces, the charming, gifted, self-centered child who turns out finally to have neither center nor self, end quote. The play follows him from very young manhood through old age into and perhaps beyond physical death. And the 38 scenes that take him through his adventures are a phantasmagoria of pathos and comedy, the domestic and the exotic, the realistic and the supernatural, the plain and the fantastical. Peer's adventures begin at a wedding when he abducts the bride, then abandons her on a mountain pass. It is also where he meets the beautiful Solveig, and he will spend the rest of his life staying out of the arms of the woman who loves him, and whom he loves in return, without being able to admit it. The prelude to Act One is subtitled In the Wedding Garden. The impulsive first theme is Peer's. And the slower woodwind melody with harp accompaniment is the first time we hear Solveig's song, which will be a recurring theme. The solo viola gives us a taste of Norwegian folk dances, with patterns based on traditional Hardanger fiddling. The prelude to Act Two is called Abduction of the Bride, Ingrid's Lament. It is subtitled Andante Doloroso, Moderately Slow and Sorrowful. After being banished for kidnapping Ingrid, Peer encounters three herd girls in a mountain pasture. Their boyfriends have abandoned them, and they are looking for troll lovers. In a scene full of thinly disguised innuendo, Per asserts that he is man enough to service all three of them, and they take him on. After a vigorous and drunken dance, Per leaves the herd girls and, possibly in his dreams, meets the woman in green. In a scene in which it's not quite clear who is seducing whom, he promises to be good to her. "We princes don't beat women," he says. The scene ends with a parody of the herd girls' music, and Per and the woman ride off on a huge pig that Per, in his delusion, thinks is a magnificent charger. The woman in green turns out to be the daughter of the mountain king of the trolls, and the next episode leads them to that kingdom. The trolls, in the words of Ibsen biographer M.C. Bradbrook, are the animal version of man, the alternative to man, also what man fears he may become. End quote. In the Hall of the Mountain King of the Trolls takes a fairly simple phrase and turns it into a tour de force for orchestra. Grieg, though, once said it was something I literally can't bear listening to because it absolutely reeks of cow pies, exaggerated Norwegian nationalism, and trollish self-satisfaction. But I have a hunch that the irony will be discernible. End quote. The Dance of the Troll King's Daughter is a galumphing, exotically orchestrated piece over a series of drone basses. After the dance, the king demands that Per marry the now pregnant troll princess. When Per refuses, the king commands his children to bash him to bits on the rocks. Peer Gynt, hunted by the trolls, begins with an exaggerated version of the Hall of the Mountain King theme and ends when its violence is stopped, like the trolls themselves, by the sound of distant church bells. In the meantime, Peer has gone deeper into the mountain, and in the scene with the boig, he encounters an invisible creature, which might just be his conscience. Once again, he escapes. In Act 3, Per visits his mother, Åsa. Åsa has lost almost everything, and Per finds her in the last moments of her life. In a scene as moving as any ever invented for the stage, he uses the enchantment of his imagination and his voice to make her final passage a magical voyage to Soria Moria, the castle east of the sun and west of the moon. Her cot is a sleigh, and her cat becomes the steed Grana. When she is gone, Per touches his cheek to her lips. Act 4 begins with the famous morning mood, setting the scene in the rocky ground overlooking the North African desert. Per's path has led him through many lands and lives. As a prosperous businessman, he trades in African slaves and Chinese idols, betraying both the human and the divine. He pretends to be and is accepted as a prophet, and more his speech becomes a jumble of misquotations of the Bible, Shakespeare, Goethe, Proverbs, friends, adversaries, and even himself. We see Per in Oriental costume, reclining on cushions, drinking coffee, and smoking a hookah in an Arab chieftain's tent. A group of young women dance and sing for him. Then the seductive Anitra dances for him solo, in a waltz for muted strings with a triangle. Per is smitten by Anitra, but ends up being duped by her as she gallops off on his horse with most of his possessions. Alone again, naturally, Per sits outside his tent and sings a serenade to Anitra. Ibsen ends Act 4 back north, at the hut Per built for Solveig and where he abandoned her. Solveig, middle-aged and still lovely, sits in the sunlight, spinning and singing. In Act 5, after many voyages and adventures that take him, among other places, to San Francisco, after a grim episode in a madhouse and even a shipwreck, Per returns to Norway an old man. The prelude to Act 5, Peer Gynt's homecoming, A Stormy Night at Sea, depicts his tempestuous journey. Back home, Peer encounters Solveig for the first time since his youth. He hears her sing in her hut, but is still not ready to face her. In the night scene, Per finds himself on a charred and fog-bound moor, maybe dead, maybe just dreaming. Here, the thoughts he never thought, the songs he should have sung, the tears unshed, the deeds not done, all visit him in the form of thread balls, withered leaves, a sighing in the air, dewdrops, and broken straws. Out of this despair, Per grows new hope and energy. He approaches the hut where he had abandoned the young Solveig. She is old now, too, and nearly blind. Churchgoers sing a hymn on the distant forest path. The final scene may seem like sentimental realism, but it is Per's final fantasy. Solveig refuses to pronounce him a sinner and cradles him in her lap. The The last words of the play are those of Solveig's lullaby, rising and growing stronger in the brightening sunshine of early morning, with the Pentecost hymn heard in the background. Peer Gynt may have been the last great verse drama in European literature, but it may also have been one of the first modern psychodramas, moving seamlessly across time and space and between reality and fantasy. Grieg's music captures its many moods, and it has helped make it the most widely performed Norwegian play ever. Grieg recognized the power in his music and arranged two orchestral suites of some of his score's highlights. But hearing the complete score, even without Ibsen's complete drama, one can truly appreciate how remarkable this artistic collaboration was. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.